America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin. The idea that the holder of the most powerful office in the world, President of the United States, has to respond to all manner of questions from press gaggles at the White House, as he's ending remarks anywhere, or as he's boarding transport here and abroad, is a great tradition. The reporters are asking questions we want answered. Historically, presidents have enjoyed and appreciated the role of the free press or bristled at their contentious questions. We explore that history on today's podcast and remind ourselves of the importance of press access to information from a president as the powers of the office continue to grow. All that today on America Trends.
With us on America Trends is John Marshall. And he's a professor at Northwestern University. He's written a book called Clash, Presidents and the Press in Times of Crisis. Now, I think a lot of people might like to go back only to the Trump presidency and say that there was incredible friction between the media and the president. But it goes so far back, and your book gives us a historical romp looking at the presidencies. Now, George Washington, we've got to start there. I mean, did he get off pretty easily compared to his successor, John Adams?
First of all, Larry, thank you for having me on the show. It's a pleasure to be with you and have this conversation. So George Washington got off pretty easily in his first term. He was a larger-than-life figure for the young nation and was much exalted by the population. Things began to get a little bit rougher in his second term as an opposition party started its early formation. They called themselves Democratic Republican Clubs at that point, and they eventually became a Republican Party and then morphed into what we now have as the Democratic Party. But anyway, starting in his Washington's second term, there began to be newspapers and pamphlets that were oriented towards this emerging Republican Party, and they began to criticize Washington and some of his policies, but not nearly to the extent that they did with John Adams when he was elected after George Washington's two terms.
Well, John Adams is a good place in many ways to start, as you say, looking for partisanship. So talk about that. I mean, what happened to John Adams?
John Adams really experienced the first deeply partisan press in the United States. Looking back at it now, I think people don't realize just how divided the country was at that point. The Federalist Party under John Adams largely supported the British in their foreign policy. The British were in this sort of ongoing conflict with France. And the new emerging Republican Party thought that Adams was going to try to restore a monarchy, make his son John Quincy Adams the prince and have John Quincy follow right after him, and was going to take on way too much power. And the Federalists, meantime, thought that these new Republicans were too closely allied with France, who just had this bloody revolution, and that bloody revolution was going to come to the United States. And they also greatly feared immigrants coming over from France, and we started to get our first Irish immigrants, and this kind of anti-immigrant rhetoric we hear today was very prevalent then as well against immigrants coming from France and Ireland and starting to be some Germans as well. So great deal of fear, great level of political conflict, and newspapers and pamphlets that were associated with this new Republican Party went very strongly after John Adams. And meanwhile, the newspapers and pamphlets associated with Adams and the Federalist Party and Alexander Hamilton went very vigorously after the Republicans, with some really vicious kind of name calling going on. And it got to the point that there would be, your editors would brawl in the streets over the content of what they were writing.
Well, I think we all remember that it was a pretty hot moment early on in the development of the American example, and that there were a lot of rags, a lot of yellow journalism, a lot of activity that really today we might look at, as much as we think we are divided today, and we are, as much as we think the press can be partisan, and there are different outlets clearly that are, the question is, what does this look like in relation to some of the things that were being written and said in that moment early on in our history?
You know, the language then was generally more flowery than we would hear now, and I actually think their insults were more creative. They called each other toad eaters and sycophantic hypocrites and I think more creative language than the sort of partisan insults we have now. But it was just as ugly, and in some ways worse, in that John Adams and the Federalist Congress at that point, about halfway through his term, passed the Alien and Sedition Acts, which basically made it a crime to criticize the government. And the Adams administration, the courts were very closely aligned and dominated by the Federalist, went after the opposition press in a very heated manner, and arrested and prosecuted and threw dozens of editors in jail, and as a result shut down newspapers. So we don't have that, hopefully, going on now in this country, but it did set a precedent of a president using his power to go after a free press.
Well, while we don't have, thankfully, the Sedition Act, we have seen, as you recount in your book, in the Obama years even, the Espionage Act being used, trying to really muzzle whistleblowers. We have seen, of course, a very contentious presidency where Donald Trump felt that it was necessary to diminish the press and to really excoriate the press so as to get people to believe that anything they said that was deleterious to him was fake news.
Well, that's right. So the Obama administration dusted off the Espionage Act that had been passed in 1917 by the Wilson administration, Woodrow Wilson's administration during World War I, to go after people they suspected of being spies. The Obama administration used it close to 10 times, I think it was 8 or 9 times, against whistleblowers who released information to reporters that was embarrassing to the United States. And the Obama administration argued that it endangered national security. And they used the Espionage Act twice as more times, actually, than all other presidents combined. And so that was a very vigorous and I think dangerous action on the part of the Obama administration to try to intimidate sources from talking with journalists. Now, towards the end of the Obama's 2 terms, his Justice Department backed down away from that a bit after a lot of protest on the part of journalism organizations. But it did serve as a chilling precedent. Trump's administration used it as well against some whistleblowers. And you asked about Trump trying to diminish the press, which was certainly a feature of his administration, was really a key strategy of his administration. As you said, if you diminish the press and tell people it's fake news, then he as a leader can get away with saying just about anything to his followers and having them believe that anything that challenges that can't be believed. And really the first president to use this strategy in any kind of sustained way was Richard Nixon. Presidents before Nixon complained about the press, tried to manipulate the press, maybe from time to time lied to the press, but it was a definite coherent strategy on the part of the administration, Nixon administration, that he talked about with his chief of staff, H.R. Haldeman, that they were going to cast the press as an enemy, as a dangerous institution, something that's dangerous like crime or like drugs or foreign adversaries, an institution that Americans, real Americans, should be wary of and not trust. That worked for a little while for Nixon, and then he ran into his own problems. But the Trump administration went full throttle with that strategy, and at least in terms of getting his backers not to believe the press, was rather successful at it.
How does the public's trust in the media, and of course use of the term media, you say, supplanted press, and that made it seem somewhat more manipulative for some reason, that term, but how does that correlate to a president's popularity? Is there an inverse relationship? I mean, if they're better watchdogs and they're keeping, you know, somebody on their toes, thus they're doing a better job, does that benefit both the president and the press? Or how does that work, that trust factor?
I think the trust in the press and trust in the president sometimes is correlated and sometimes it's not. I think it really depends. I'd have to go back over the opinion polls, but from ones that I've seen, there's a general decline in trust in a lot of U.S. institutions, including the presidency, including Congress, including the media. And that's been a general trend since the 1970s, at least. But there have been times as well when the post-Watergate era, when trust in the press and the media did go up, largely as a result of that Watergate era reporting, while trust in the presidency was going down. So there are times when they are correlated together in a mostly downward trend, but there's also instances when the press or the president distinguish themselves in a way that separates them. So the opposite of that was probably after the 9/11 attacks, when George W. Bush's popularity went way up in the first year or so after 9/11, while the popularity of the press did not go up in a similar way.
Well, we are in the midst of a terrible situation in Ukraine, and we know that the Biden administration, coming in after the Trump administration, and the Trump administration tried to use the new technology to go around the press. You know, he would speak directly through social media, Twitter in particular. And I think the Biden administration has tried to go back to more mainstream approaches. You don't hear about tweets coming from Joe Biden. And here we are in what looks like wartime stance for the United States, at least peripherally. And what does that normally do to the relationship between the news media, the press, and the president?
Well, that's a great question. First of all, I should say the Biden administration is using social media and using it a lot. Lots of posts on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook and so forth, mm-hmm. but they're not nearly as incendiary and controversial as Trump's post. They've kind of tried to cool down the temperature of it and use it in maybe a more sort of statesmanlike style, so it doesn't get nearly as much attention as Trump's tweets did. But I think you're right that the Biden administration is generally doing a more maybe called traditional approach, or at least traditional for the last few decades of the presidency, of really trying to use television and news conferences and prepared statements to get its messaging across. In the weeks before Russia invaded Ukraine, I was curious about why they were spending so much of their messaging time about Ukraine when the conflict hadn't started. But in retrospect, I think it was a wise and smart move, because it really prepared the country for the possibility that there would be this Russian invasion. And they very effectively cast Putin as the enemy, as the aggressor, who was going to be someone that the American public had to be highly concerned about. So once the conflict began, the American public was prepared, and I think more easily, at least large parts of the public rallied around the president, which tends to be what happens, at least in the first months or year of a foreign conflict. The public does tend to be generally supportive of U.S. foreign policy. Then the challenge is if the war drags on and there's more and more difficulties for the public domestically, say, because of rising oil prices or other reasons, then that support for the president becomes much more tenuous.
Well, I can remember, I'm old enough, Vietnam. I can remember when basically the war was lost, or the effort to try to manage the communications about what was going on far away. And that was when Walter Cronkite basically gave up on the war. That was enough to really, in many ways, spell the end of the LBJ presidency.
Right. So that year, 1968, Walter Cronkite traveled to Vietnam to do firsthand reporting. And as you and probably most of your listeners know, Cronkite was the most highly watched. He and NBC at that point were sort of in a neck and neck race for the ratings. But later on, one poll named him the most trusted man in America. So when CBS News anchor Walter Cronkite goes to Vietnam, does some reporting, and then at the end of his report on the CBS Evening News says he doesn't think the war is winnable for the United States, and the best thing for the United States to do would be to negotiate an honorable withdrawal. That was a real stab at President Lyndon Johnson's policy towards Vietnam. And Johnson is believed to have said to his aides, well, if I've lost Walter Cronkite, then I've lost Middle America. And soon after that, Lyndon Johnson announced that he would not run for another term as president. And of course, the war dragged on for about five more years after that, and Richard Nixon continued to send more troops over and continued to bomb there. But at that point, a large portion of the American public was no longer supporting the war as they had done in its early years.
Don Marshall is our guest. The book is called Clash, Presidents and the Press in Times of Crisis. How often does a figure in the media, and we know Bernstein and Woodward, we know Dan Rather challenging Richard Nixon, what we just talked about with Walter Cronkite, how often does someone in the media become so iconic in their exchanges, their ways of attacking a president on policy and other matters, so profoundly that they really become part of the story in a way?
Well, I think one of the most famous examples of that was Edward R. Murrow during World War II, at that point on CBS radio, when he was reporting from the rooftops of London when the Nazis were in the middle of their blitz against Britain in bombing London every night. And Murrow's live report from London was, first of all, stunning for the American public to hear because the technology was only recently possible for people in the United States to hear radio live being reported from Europe. So that the idea that they were hearing a war live was really stunning. Murrow timed his report so it would be during prime time in the United States when most people were listening. And his reports from London really galvanized a large part of the U.S. public to be much more supportive of giving aid to Britain and other allies who were fighting the Nazis even before the U.S. entered the war. So that, I think that's the first example that comes to mind. And then Murrow, once he returned to the United States and became a TV star on CBS News, it wasn't a president he went after, but he went after U.S. Senator Joseph McCarthy, who was in the middle of his witch hunt against people accusing American citizens right and left, often falsely, of being communist. When Edward R. Murrow did a half-hour show about McCarthy on See It Now in 1954, that really was a big turning point in bringing about the end of McCarthyism. Harder today for someone like Murrow or Cronkite or even Woodward and Bernstein to stand out because we're now in an age of everyone has their own instant personalized media stream, whether it's through social media, as my students and my own children use, or and my friends and myself as well, or different cable channels or different talk radio shows. There's literally thousands of ways to get information or misinformation about what's going on in the world. So it's much more difficult for any one journalist to stand out as someone that the public is getting their information from, and for that journalist to become iconic, as you said.
In your book, we are struck, and I would encourage you to read this book, about the fact that from the early years, we have seen presidents try to attack and restrict and manipulate the press. So this goes back to our founding. It's nothing new. You talk about all the technological advances, some of which really redounded to the benefit of one president or another. I think the fireside chats, FDR, radio, masterful. The news conferences, of course, of JFK, where he just wowed the press with his personality and his charisma. But at the same time, you remind us that technological advances have fragmented the media and now enhance the president's ability to avoid the press corps, if they want, today in particular. And some call this the era of TikTok and Instagram and Facebook. So tell us what those changes technologically have meant to the presidency and the press.
You're right to point to Franklin Roosevelt and his fireside chats during the Great Depression and during World War II. And he could ask the two dominant radio networks, CBS and NBC, to give him time, which they did because FDR was very popular on radio, and they also wanted to please the president. And a majority of Americans could hear him. They would gather in their living rooms or in taverns or wherever they might be, and listen to the president's fireside addresses. And JFK had that ability when there were only three TV networks, CBS, NBC, ABC, in the 1960s when he was president. If he had a news conference, they were going to carry it, and most Americans would see and hear it. But now, with most cable packages having hundreds of choices for television and on the social media, millions of choices of where people can go, if Joe Biden holds a press conference, the cable news channels are likely to carry it. Maybe the TV networks will carry it. Maybe NPR or a few other radio stations will carry it. It might be in the daily newspapers the next day. But there's a large percentage of the American public that's never going to see or hear it. Or what they see and hear might be a 10-second clip of it, which, depending on the partisanship of the media outlet, can frame what the president said one way or another. An outlet that's not liking Joe Biden can choose his most embarrassing moment and play that over and over again through memes and TikToks and on Fox News, the same clip over and over again. A channel that's supportive of Biden can emphasize what they feel are his strongest points. And it makes it much harder for Americans to even have a conversation about what's going on in our country or what's going on in the world where we have any kind of common understanding of what the basic facts are, because people are in their bubbles and getting very different facts. And it makes it much more difficult for a president to reach out to a majority of the country.
You remind us that presidents who nurture really good relationships with reporters have more long-term success than those who don't. I think Ronald Reagan comes to mind. I just want to go back before I want to go forward to where the news business is today and some of the impact on the reporting in the White House and other places. But Lincoln, because there's so much about Abraham Lincoln that is so fascinating. I just did a podcast with Noah Feldman, and I never really thought about it in the context of the fact that Abe Lincoln did a lot of things that he had no authority to do, but he said, well, the world's so scrambled, you've seceded, so I'm going to make up some of the rules. And then, in fact, the Constitution that he rebuilt was a very different Constitution than we started with in 1787. So my question is, with Abe Lincoln, for example, I mean, he was a wartime president, clearly. What was the press? But he was also, having some real fights with the media. Didn't he shut some papers down?
Yes, he certainly did. Or I should say his military did, and he allowed it to happen and didn't intervene. And, we talked about the divided times during John Adams' presidency. We've talked about divided times now. We've talked about the Vietnam era, where it was certainly divided, but it's hard to find a moment in U.S. history that was more divided than the Civil War. And the press was equally divided, and wasn't just North newspapers in the North and newspapers in the South that were disagreeing vehemently about it. But even within the North, the Republican and Democratic newspapers, the Democratic newspapers were much more sympathetic to the South and more sympathetic to keeping the institution of slavery going. And they went after Lincoln in very strenuous and often vicious ways and often racist ways as well. And at certain points, different generals in the Union military would decide to shut down a newspaper, one in my town of Chicago, the Chicago Times, which was a very pro-democratic newspaper, pro-South newspaper, was shut down at one point. Similar thing in Baltimore as well, where there's some Confederate sympathy. They weren't shut down permanently, and Lincoln eventually allowed them to keep going. But there was that precedent that Woodrow Wilson took up during World War I, that in a time of crisis, in a time of war, it might be justified to shut down a newspaper, which I believe is a very dangerous precedent. The flip side of that with Lincoln was the very interesting relationship he established with the abolitionist press, which had for decades been arguing for emancipation and an end to slavery, and had really been considered sort of on the fringe of political discourse. They were considered wild-eyed radicals. But as the war continued, Lincoln understood that he really needed the support of the abolitionists and needed the support of Black Americans in the North to win the war. And he developed a very interesting friendship with the leading abolitionist of the time, Frederick Douglass, where he would seek Douglass's advice and Douglass's support. And that really, the efforts of Douglass and of abolitionist editors like William Lloyd Garrison really pushed Lincoln, I think, to go quicker than he would have otherwise towards the Emancipation Proclamation and the supporting the 13th Amendment and other rights for enslaved people and for freeing the slaves.
You remind us that changes in laws, particularly during the Reagan presidency, and he was popular with the press, but they released this powerful wave of partisan divisive journalism. The fairness doctrine was struck. So if you want to hear all liberal talk or all conservative talk, there's no need to balance any of that. Then, of course, we have Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act going back to 1996 under Bill Clinton, and that gave somewhat free rein so that various platforms were not going to be responsible for some of the speech on it, like Facebook and such. So here we are at a really critical moment where we've also got people going around what is considered, quote unquote, the mainstream press, Donald Trump clearly among them. And my question to you is, in this changing time of technology and how people are getting their news, should journalists retain objectivity when they detect massive amounts of lying and deception? Or how should they cover that? Just call it out? Because I know a lot of people say, oh, they're biased against him or her. But in fact, what they're saying is, look, this person is giving you a pile of rubbish that you've got to, you know, we can't let that sit there and go unanswered or unexplained.
That's a great question. And it's a question I talk a lot about with my students, and we have a discussion about that at Medill School of Journalism, where I work, sort of the changing notions of objectivity, which I think is really sort of widely misunderstood. Journalists should follow the facts. Our first obligation is to seek the truth and to report it, to quote from the Society of Professional Journalists Code of Ethics. And that doesn't mean giving equal time to one side that is giving a fact-based narrative of what has happened, and then giving equal time to a side that's making things up. All sides should be fact-checked. Information should be verified. And if one person or group is trying to give information, or in this case it would be misinformation, that's not factual, you either don't report it, or if you report it, you put it in the context that it's not true to what's going on in the world. And we've seen an increase in sort of fact-checking sites that do that, and those have been around for a decade or more. But I think what we saw for the first time in the Trump administration is an instance where a president was lying so frequently on a daily and sometimes hourly basis that a lot of the press decided that it was the responsible thing for them to do would be to put that in a factual context and say what the president, Donald Trump, just said is untrue. And yet either not report it, but it's hard to ignore what a president is saying because of how much power a president has. So to report it, but put it in the context that this is an untruth. And the New York Times started to do that in the 2016 campaign when Trump was first running. And I remember when there was a full page the New York Times ran of all the things that Trump had said during the campaign that wasn't true. And it was kind of a stunning moment in journalism for a leading news outlet to do that. But I think it was the right thing to do. They should do the same thing, and they do the same thing for Democratic politicians and liberal politicians. And certainly other presidents have lied before. Bill Clinton lied about his sex life, and the press reported about that in a very vigorous way. Certainly Nixon lied about Watergate. Johnson lied about Vietnam. So the notion that journalists are only doing that towards Trump or towards conservatives, I don't think true. They've been just as tough in calling out misinformation for other presidents as well.
Well, I had somebody the other day say to me, you know, it was interesting that we saw all these death counts during COVID until Trump left office. And I said, no, that's not true. I would see the death counts. How come I know that they're close to 900,000 if they weren't being reported after Donald Trump left office? But there is this sense, and everybody has their own prism into this discussion about what is emphasized or de-emphasized depending upon the administration. But I want to ask you something else, though. No briefings, blocking reporters from getting visitor logs, information like schedules. In other words, the White House press corps, what do they really need from a president to really be able to do their jobs? And when they came into residence in the White House, did that change the relationship? Is that really good that many are on site all the time? I'm not certain exactly what they're picking up at any moment walking into offices. I remember when I was an assistant to the Commissioner of Education in Connecticut, I had a reporter who used to look at my desk from her perch and try to see anything I had on my desk. So tell me what that does, that proximity.
I think there's two parts to what you asked. What do they need, and then is it a good thing that they're there? I think what they need is accurate information told on a timely basis, and the ability to question people in authority, including the president, including cabinet secretaries, including top officials in the White House, to be able to ask questions about what's going on so they can explain it to their viewers and their listeners and their readers. The Biden administration restored regular press briefings by the press secretary, which during the Trump administration, they went more than a year without briefing the press. So that was a good thing. Biden hasn't been especially available for interviews, which has been a trend through most of the recent presidents. Trump was actually an anomaly in terms of how accessible he was to reporters. He was known to call them up all the time and try to sway them to his viewpoint or just trade gossip. And that was an anomaly compared to Obama and W. Bush, who really tried to control access to the president. So I think that's what the journalists need is regular, reliable information and then the ability to ask questions. Is it good that there is so much focus on the White House and that there's so many reporters there? I think it's probably too much. There should be reporters in the White House, you know, in case something sudden happens, a national crisis. You know, God forbid, the president who goes to the hospital for COVID treatment, as Donald Trump did, you need to have reporters there at the time to report that. So it's good that there's a White House press corps, but I think there's been a gradual emphasis, really dating back to World War II, and it's only increased since then during the Cold War, and in the decades since then, to put more and more emphasis on the presidency in what is being covered. For one reason, obviously presidents have a lot of power, but in some ways it's easier to cover the president. There's only one key person, and if the president makes a speech, then you've got your news, or if the president gives an interview, then you've got your news. It's much harder to cover Congress. It's much harder to cover all the different government agencies who are making regulations and checking on things that affect people's lives on a daily basis. And it's much harder to cover all the state houses and city councils around the country. And I'm afraid what we have now is probably too much emphasis on Washington and not enough emphasis by journalists on local news and statewide news, where a lot of the decisions are being made that affect people on a day-to-day basis. And one of the reasons for that is just the whole changing economics.
Well, I do want to, can I say this? I don't want to go on too much longer because I don't want the audience, I want them to listen to the whole thing, and it's hard probably to go on much longer. However, I've never really done this before, but I'm going to ask you if at some point in the near future we could get back together on the phone to talk about the last chapter or so in your book about the state of news today, local journalism, sustainability of it, the business models changing, the Chicago Tribune in your backyard and the Hartford Current in my backyard, what's happened to them. So I'd love to have another conversation with you about some of those issues, but leave the one about the presidents and the press in times of crisis, your book Clash, where it is, and then pick it up at another time. Would that be all right?
Oh, I would be very happy to have another conversation with you, Larry. I've enjoyed this one immensely.
Well, thank you so much, and we will talk about that, but we'll end this for now, and I know people are going to be interested in getting the book. It's called Clash, John Marshall. Thanks again.
Thank you.